Good afternoon, friends.
Good afternoon.
My name is Joe Schwartzberg. Most of you know me. And I'm the Director Emeritus of the Reckable World Trust. And we have a panel on transforming the United Nations for you this evening. And the panelists will be myself. I'll start it and say very few words because I'm no longer capable of speaking at great length. And it'll take over from Nancy Dunleavy, who is the director of the Reckable World Trust and a very valued colleague. And then another very old friend, Ron Glossop, whom I've known for decades. I don't know how many decades. Actually, I've known Nancy for decades, come to think of it. And he will also add his comments to ours. So with this small group, we need to have lengthy introductions. And I'd like to talk a bit about a book I've written called Transforming the United Nations. This is the cover. It was published by the United Nations University Press. And the editor at the United Nations University Press wrote to me a month before it was published. He said, "I don't believe we've ever had a book published which has had as many notable and prestigious endorsers as yours." Let's forgive the shameless self-promotion here, but...
But it has to be done.
At any rate, if any of you who don't... A lot of you in whom I'm looking at already have the book, but if you don't have it, we have copies for sale across the river at our table, Reckable World Trust and CGS, Citizens for Global Solutions, with which I've been affiliated for a long time, and before that with the World Federalist Association. Well, I'd like to just talk a little about the title of the book, because every word there is quite significant. Transforming the United Nations system. Transforming. Why not reforming? Everybody talks about reform. The reason is that the UN needs a lot more than just the sort of tinkering with the system that is characteristic of most reform proposals, of which there are a great many which don't make news for the simple reason is that the United States in particular, but all the great powers as a rule, don't really want a reformed UN. They like the UN weak as it is so that they can use it as a sounding board when it suits their interests or ignore it when it doesn't suit their interests. So that's the present state of affairs. But so when they talk about reforming the UN, they say, add two seats to the Security Council or change the operating procedures in such and such an agency or make a tweak the revenue system slightly. There are mostly cosmetic changes, but this book talks about a wholesale reformation, starting with where we are. A lot of people who we associate with have grand visions of where the UN ought to be going, but very little conception of how to get there. They think they're on third base and trying to get to home plate. In fact, they haven't yet reached first base, and they don't realize that. So at any rate, transformation, we should tell it like it is. That's what it is. Changing the architecture of the whole system. Then the United Nations system. We don't realize that it is a system. It's embedded into a larger world system, but we have to approach it in a holistic way and see the United Nations as a group of agencies trying, not very earnestly, but trying from time to time to deal with problems that affect the world global community. And so we have to have a systemic approach rather than an atomized approach where we take up one agency at a time. We need a vision, and the book tries to provide a vision. And then the word designs is quite important. Why designs? One of the premises of the book is that the design of a decision-making system has an effect on whether that system is viable or not. In other words, the efficacy and the legitimacy of the decisions has a lot to do with design. So we pay a lot of attention to to design issues, some of which Nancy will talk about. And so design is quite important. And then for a workable world, why a workable world rather than a perfect world? Because, as you've heard from the session we just came from, a lot of people think that trying to make the put the world on a sustainable course is utopian. And that's it happens to be an incorrect perception, but it is the reality with which we have to cope. So the question then is, how do we actually make the world workable? People say, well, they'll have different views as how far down a particular path they want to go, but the important thing is that you march in the correct direction. And so you can disagree on the goal. Some people like me and Ron and Nancy and a number of the others here think of a world democratic federal government. I don't emphasize that in the book because we're so far from, we're not on first base yet. We have to get to first base before we can get to home plate. And so we want a world that's workable, and we can disagree about how far down a particular path we want to go. But the fact is that global problems demand global solutions, and we're not addressing this issue with that recognition in our minds, and we have to do so. So that's enough. I will be dealing again with your questions and answers, but I'd like Nancy to take over now. This is Nancy Dunleavy, without whom the Workable World Trust really wouldn't be more than a shadow of what it is today. Thank you, Nancy.
Well, I just want to clarify that what I'm going to share with you, the script that goes along with the PowerPoint, is coming from Joe's book. So, in a sense, I am Joe Schwartzberg as I'm up here speaking to you. Dunleavy, D-U-N-L-A-V, like Victor, Y. And Joe mentioned that we have a table across the bridge with our books and literature. I actually brought copies of the books and the study guide and some of our literature along, so you can actually, you know, look at that if you'd like after. So I am going to... Joe talked about the title of the book. I'm going to basically read the script here for you. Presently, decision-making in the UN agencies follows the rule of one nation, one vote, based on the presumed sovereignty of nations. This flies in the face of reality. Consider population. Nauru, the UN's least populous member with 9,300 people, has the same vote in virtually all UN nations as China does with 1.35 billion people, whose population is 145,000 times greater. If one considers the size of the economy, the ratio between the US and Tuvalu is roughly 560,000 to 1. But Tuvalu's vote is equal to that of the US. In fact, there are so many insignificant nations in terms of in the UN that the 128 smallest, which collectively account for roughly 8% of the world's total population, can muster the two-thirds majority needed to pass a resolution in the General Assembly, while the 65 smallest nations, accounting for only 1% of the world's total, can prevent a resolution supported by the remaining 99%. Is it any wonder, then, that the GA resolutions are not binding? They command little respect and are ignored with impunity. Things are not much better in the anachronistic Security Council, in which five nations that happen to be on the winning side in World War II enjoy permanent membership and the privilege of the veto, which are denied to such powers as India, Japan, Germany, and Brazil, and many others, and in which an often motley assortment of 10 additional nations, often undemocratic ones, serve overlapping two-year terms. The unfairness of this dispensation is almost universally condemned, but while scores of reform proposals have been put forward, none has found sufficient favor to be adopted. Bottom line, most important decisions are made outside the UN by the self-appointed G8 or G20 powers, by organizations of the global north, such as NATO, by conventional power political diplomacy, or unilaterally by the U.S. when our government deems it politically expedient to do so. And of course, many tough problems, such as climate change or the civil war in Syria, are either seriously neglected or even totally ignored. There has to be a better way. I've got, it's not showing there, but something for the network is coming up, so that's why I didn't have access. There we go. Okay, the need for weighted voting. If UN decisions on matters of global importance are to command respect and be regarded as legitimate, they call for appropriately weighted voting. They must be made according to rules that are widely regarded as fair and by a system in which the allocation of power bears some resemblance to the distribution of power in the real world, outside the UN itself. Population has to matter. And if economic powers, those who will have to pay most of the costs that decisions will entail, are to get in the game, economic power must matter as well. That does not mean that one has to completely ignore sovereignty, but it does mean making sovereignty but one factor in the allocation of decision-making power. With these thoughts in mind, I, Joe Schwartzberg, have designed a number of simple weighted voting formulae, the terms of which are related to the functions of specific UN agencies. In the General Assembly, let us first consider the General Assembly. The formula I recommend is as follows: W equals P plus C plus M over 3, in which a nation's voting weight is the average of three terms: P, the nation's population as a percentage of the world's total population; C, the nation's assessed contribution to the UN budget as a percentage of the total budget; and M, the nation's membership as a sovereign entity as a percentage of the total membership, which in the present UN with 193 members would come to 0.52% per nation. For the United States, the weight would come to 9.9% of the world's total. China would rank second at 9.6%, though it would pass the U.S. in the not-too-distant future.
It already has.
We already have. Okay, we checked these numbers last year, and now again this year it has made that switch. India would rank third at 6.7%, Japan next at 3.5%, Germany at 2.5%, France, Brazil, and the UK at roughly 2% each, and so forth. At the bottom end of the hierarchy would be a number of microstates, such as Nauru and Tuvalu, with weights of 0.17% each. The ratio of the U.S.'s weight to that of these microstates would be 57 to 1. If adopted today, this proposed system would increase the combined voting weight of nations ranked by Freedom House as, quote, free, from 44% to 55%. The weight of nations with relatively advanced economies, those in the OECD, would be increased from 17% to 36%. In all, 31 member nations would have their weights increased from their present uniform 0.52%. But these states account for 78% of the world's population and 86% of the world's total GNI. Their combined voting weight would rise from 16% to 60% of the total. But why, one might ask, would the 162 nations whose collective weight would go down from 84% to 40% of the total vote to adopt a system that would substantially reduce their power? Good question. The answer would have to entail an enhancement of the power of the General Assembly, changing it from an impotent, little-respected talk shop to a legislature empowered to make binding decisions in matters of truly global importance. Initially, the range of such matters would be narrow, limited, let us say, to issues posing existential threats, such as nuclear proliferation or climate change, and gradually expanding in the light of need and experience. The argument would then be that 40% of something a UN that could deliver tangible and gradually increasing benefits is a great deal better than 86% of what is in effect nothing. Moreover, if the major powers came to the realization that the proposed changes were indeed necessary, the lesser powers would, I believe, see it in their interest to go along.
Would you like to explain why the M is over 3?
The whole thing is over 3.
Yeah, it's P plus C plus M, the whole thing, divided by 3.
And why is that?
The average of 3 percentages. Because there are 3 principles involved, and there's no logical way to say which is the superior principle. Some people will argue for wealth, some people, populous countries like India and China will argue for population, small countries will argue for sovereignty. It's a question of how do you say that we're right and you're wrong. So this is a compromise proposal. But let's save the questions, if you don't mind, madam, till the end of the presentation.
But it is important to see that this is P plus C plus 3, the whole thing.
The whole thing over 3. We could maybe...
Not just M over 3.
Yeah. And the formula is changeable. I mean, one thing I could just add to this since we started... If the UN to become more democratic, for instance, the P could become 2P, and then all of a sudden the weight of the voice of people could increase with that. So anyway, we can discuss that at great length in the Q&A session, if that's okay. Okay, so now a World Parliamentary Assembly. I spoke a moment ago of the General Assemblies becoming a global legislature. But legislatures typically represent people as well as states, and often even to the exclusion of states. The UN, however, despite the initial words of the Charter, "We the peoples," is an organization of nation states with virtually no recognition of people, either as individuals or collectives. Its democratic deficit is profound. Happily, in many parts of the world, a movement is growing, though only barely as yet in the United States, in support of a UN or World Parliamentary Assembly. Worldwide, more than 1,100 parliamentarians, including more than 800 incumbents, as well as numerous other eminent individuals, are on record as supporting the establishment of such a body. Several years ago, I had the pleasure of attending a conference on the UN Parliamentary Assembly hosted by the European Parliament in Brussels. European Parliament in Brussels, in which participants from 27 countries set out a roadmap to bring its project to fruition. If established, the Assembly would become analogous to the U.S. House of Representatives, while the General Assembly would be the analog of the U.S. Senate. The idea would be to begin with a body in which parliamentarians would be elected by the legislatures of the member states and in which decisions would be strictly of an advisory nature rather than binding. Over time, however, as was the case in Europe, the powers of the assembly would be gradually increased and the members of the assembly would be chosen by direct popular elections. Obviously, the process would be slow and complicated, but it is eminently doable. In a monograph published in 2012 by the Berlin-based Committee for a Democratic UN, Creating a World Parliamentary Assembly, an Evolutionary Journey, I spelled out a 3-stage process by which a truly democratic body could be established. As in the European Parliament, weighted voting would be necessary, and I have devised several formulae to deal with this issue, with a gradual shift toward the one-person, one-vote ideal. The details are presented in one chapter of my new book. Interestingly, in contrast to many structural changes that I recommend, creating a UN Parliamentary Assembly would not require charter reform, in that Article 22 reads as follows, quote, "The General Assembly may establish such subsidiary organs as it deems necessary for the performance of its functions," end quote. Legal opinion indicates that a UNPA could be regarded as a GA subsidiary organ. Now the Security Council. Let me turn now to the Security Council, the only entity within the UN proper that exercises theoretically binding powers, the one that is most frequently in the news, and the one that has by far generated the greatest number of reform proposals. Despite some successes, the record of the Security Council has been remarkably spotty. It failed utterly to prevent genocide in Rwanda. It has proved virtually impotent in the present civil war in Syria. It has not stopped nuclear proliferation or brought about disarmament, and it has done virtually nothing to enforce human rights treaties that are a part of international law. Moreover, the Council is remarkably undemocratic. The only times when its membership has accounted for more than half the world's population were in 10 of the 12 years when India held a seat. And in 1965, when Taiwan still held the permanent seat reserved for China, the Security Council membership represented a mere 17% of the world's people. In that year, the six non-permanent members, of which the Netherlands was the most populous, accounted for only 1% of humanity. Anomalies abound. Panama, for example, despite having only a 40th of the population of Mexico, has served for 10 years as opposed to Mexico's 9. For 4 years, Africa was supposedly represented by the tiny island nation of Mauritius, most of whose population is ethnically Indian. But, quote, represented is not really the right word, in that the ambassador from Mauritius, like those from all other non-permanent members, votes in the interests of his own country rather than in the interests of the region he theoretically represents. Finally, 72 nations have never served on the Security Council at all. But once on the Council, the votes of every member nation are equal. Thus, the vote of Malta, which with roughly half the population of Minneapolis is the least populous nation ever to have served a Security Council seat, has the same weight as that of any other Security Council member, except in respect to the veto, which only the P5, including Taiwan until 1972, can employ. There have been literally scores of proposals for increasing the size of the Security Council by anywhere from 1 to 10 additional seats, thereby making it somewhat more representative. But every such proposal has run into strong opposition from the wannabe nations who would not make the cut, or because nations from the global north opposed new members from the global south, or vice versa. To the best of my knowledge, my own proposal is the only one to advocate a smaller council and yet to become universally representative. The key is weighted regional membership. I recommend a council with only 12 seats. Based on a formula similar to that explained for the General Assembly, 3 of these would go to single nations, the United States, China, and India, and the remaining 9 to multinational regions, Africa south of the Sahara, the Arab League, East Asia, Europe, Latin America, and the Caribbean, Russia, and certain European neighbors, Southeast Asia, West Asia, and what I call the Westminster League, consisting of Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the 12 small island states of the Pacific Islands Forum. As with the General Assembly, a formula for allocating regional voting weights is needed. I have proposed the following. And to be clear, I'm not sure you weren't, I don't think you were unclear last time, but I'm just clarifying that the 3, again, is over the whole. You're right that we should probably have parentheses here.
When you do it in one line, you don't have to have the parentheses. When you do it in 2 lines, you do.
Okay. Mm. All right. Okay, here the terms P and C, total regional population and total contributions to the UN budget, are analogous to the same terms for individual countries in the GA formula. The third term, 8.33%, or 1/12, is a constant signifying a new legal fiction, the equal worth of each regional perspective. This is analogous to the legal fiction of the sovereignty equality of nations established by the Treaty of Westphalia. The effect of this term is to reduce the spread in voting power between the top and bottom of the power hierarchy, which would range from 15.9% for Europe to 4.5% for the Westminster League, a ratio of roughly 3.5 to 1. The United States, with a weight of 12.5%, would rank second. No region would have the power of the veto. In the United States, the near doubling of voting power from the present 6.7%, 1/15 of the total, to 12.5% might be accepted as a reasonable political trade-off for surrendering the veto. The proposed scheme would require substantial diplomatic adjustments. Choosing delegates for the 9 multi-nation regions would necessitate regional caucuses to put forward a slate of from 2 to 5 candidates per region. From each regional slate, the General Assembly would select the one it deemed best. Such a competitive procedure would lead to greater meritocracy than at present. Each region would also have to have frequent meetings of its foreign policy establishments to establish regional positions on important global issues and devise protocols to guide their respective delegates in Security Council debates. This would, of course, have been logistically impossible as little as 10 years ago, but is entirely manageable in the age of the Internet. An advantage of this new mode of interaction would be that the contacts would undoubtedly relate to matters other than those coming to the floor of the Security Council. For example, river basin development, labor standards, migration, cultural and educational exchanges, and other foreseeable aspects of regional integration. Okay, engaging civil society. A seldom noted but important provision of the United Nations Charter is that it allows certain civil society organizations, often designated as international non-governmental organizations, or INGOs, to enter into one of 3 grades of consultative status with the UN via the Economic and Social Council, known as ECOSOC. Over the years, the number of NGOs in consultative status has skyrocketed from a mere 40 in 1948 to 3,348 in 2010. And the latter figure is but a small fraction of the more than 250,000 INGOs that exist worldwide. The advice that these agencies could offer the UN is potentially invaluable. But there is no way at present that the UN can effectively process and evaluate the glut of useful information that it receives. The problem has simply not been squarely addressed. To deal with the issue, I have proposed a system whereby INGOs willing to pay a nominal membership fee and provide regular reports of their activities can be grouped into 5 thematic clusters: human rights, environment, development, peace and security, and democratic governance. Each cluster would have its own civil society coordinating council to collect, evaluate, and integrate the reports of its member organizations. But as with nations, there are enormous disparities in the strength, capability, and financial resources of INGOs. It is therefore in order to provide a weighting system for use within each coordinating council, taking into consideration each INGO's level of ECOSOC status, its budget, and the number of countries within which it operates. Additionally, coordinating councils would have regional caucuses with weights assigned according to a formula that fairly balances the strength and interests of both shareholders, meaning financial contributors, mainly from the global north, and stakeholders, or beneficiaries, mainly from the global south. Based on annual meetings, each council would make its concerns and proposed agenda known to the appropriate UN agencies. The Human Rights Coordinating Council, for example, would report primarily, but not exclusively, to the UN Human Rights Council. Unfortunately, the present Human Rights Council is a highly politicized body. Many of its 47 member nations have sought their seats on that body, not because of their genuine concern for promoting human rights, but rather to ward off criticism of their own nation's abysmal human rights record. Regrettably, I lack the time to tell you in detail how the Council might be reformed. But in a nutshell, members should be selected on a regional basis, not as nations, but rather on the basis of individual merit. Additionally, there should be a reasonable gender balance, an issue I deal with in many chapters of my book, and reserved seats for representatives of indigenous peoples. And I believe now I'm turning it over to Ron to share a little bit, and then we'll have a Q&A session with everyone. Thank you.
As you can tell, Joe has done an intensive, exhaustive amount of work to figure out the specific details on how to transform the UN and make it more effective. A workable world is the goal. I'm not going to try to add on anything to what Joe has proposed in specific things that need to be done. All I want to add is a word about the motivation of why this needs to be done and why it should be done. It has to do with how we view the world. Do we put our loyalty to our nation state above our loyalty to the world community? That, I think, is the basic problem with the United Nations. The United Nations is an association of national governments. It is designed to protect the rights and privileges of national governments. It does not concern itself with what's good for the whole world. What we need is the motivation to make the kind of transition that Joe is proposing. And I think that that comes from seeing ourselves as citizens of the world community primarily and only secondarily as members of our nation state. We in the United States are used to this idea. We have our sovereign state that we're loyal to, Missouri or Illinois or Minnesota, but our loyalty to the United States is greater. It's more important to do what's good for the United States than what's good for our own state if there's a conflict. We got to have the same kind of mentality with regard to the global community. We need to do what's best for the world, not just think in terms of what might be best for the moment for the United States. In the long term, that will also be better for all the nations. So what is it that we need is the idea of world citizenship. There's a new film that's been made called My Country is the World. It's the story of the person who is more than any other kind of the originator of the idea of world citizenship, that is Gary Davis. Gary Davis, during World War II, was a bomber pilot. His brother was also a bomber pilot who got killed. Gary Davis, after the war was over, becoming aware of the disaster that he had done, the catastrophe that he had caused as a result of his bombing, he said, something's got to be done to end this kind of destruction. And the way to do it is to become a citizen of the world. And so he renounced his United States citizenship. And he said, I am now a member of the world community. And, of course, one of the problems then was how could he go from one country to another anymore because he didn't have a national passport. So he designed a world passport. And his World Service Authority still makes that kind of global world passport available to refugees and other people who can't get visas or marriage licenses or anything within their own national government. So the World Service Authority still provides that sort of thing. Idea, though, is we've got to start thinking in new ways. We've got to start thinking in terms of being citizens of the world. And what Joe has done in his book, Transforming the UN, is making it very clear about the details on how to make that kind of change.
So I think Joe and Ron need to kind of get up to the front. You can switch your chair around or whatever.
Oh, okay.
Did you want to address your question a little more about the formulas?
I have a few other questions, so it's up to you what you want to start with. Okay, so one question I have is very specific. The nations assess contribution, not how much they pay, but how much they assess.
No, it is really how much they pay. If they don't pay, they don't get the vote.
So we don't pay very much of our assess, right, contribution to the UN.
We,
so how much they
pay? So we pay it at the last minute, and only to where we, I think you have to be at more than a quarter of your debt in arrears. I forgot the exact number, but we use it as a cudgel to make the UN do our bidding by saying we're going to hold off on our contribution until you make such and such a change, which is obviously some change in our own favor, in the favor of the United States. Our own should be the whole people of the world. So. It is in the form it is assessed and paid over a period of X number of years. I said five, but it could be three, it could be four,
so
whatever.
My more general question is, this is, I mean, I know about the UN, and I know that people have been thinking about it a long time. Are there many proposals for how to change the UN, and you've culled from that, or this is completely something that you put out, and is anyone looking at it?
I've been doing this for more than 50 years, so I've been exposed to many of those proposals. Some of them have merit, most don't.
And
but
so have people been discussing your proposals? Or I'm sorry, I'm so new to it that I don't know where you stand. And is this just an idea that you're telling us 20, or and you wrote a book, or this is somewhere being considered?
You know, I'm very hard of hearing. I missed your question.
She wants to know if this is being taken seriously.
Oh, yes. Well, among the people who have advocated, who have, if you look at the back cover of the book, former Secretary General Boutros-Ghali said that this would be essential reading for future generations. Our former Secretary of State and Assistant Secretary of State for Political Affairs, certainly I'm blacking on it.
Well, it's okay, but other people have been considering
A lot of important people have spoken in favor of this. So, yes, I work with a number of people who on the East Coast when they go to an office of the UN. We have Professor Schwartzberg's book. They know about it. Mm-hmm. But you need a critical mass before anything gets done, and we're not close to getting that critical mass. But countries like the Nordic bloc, the Netherlands, El Salvador, not El Salvador, Costa Rica, Senegal, Singapore and so forth, we're trying to, the Workable World Trust has provided $75,000 to help organize a conference on the East Coast next year or in 2018 to promote a preparatory conference on UN reform in the year 2020, when the UN will be 75 years old. So there's a lot going on that is below this, off the radar screen of a lot of people. But yes, increasingly this is being known. Ron has just come back from Korea. I got a phone call about a year ago from a radio station in South Korea that wanted to interview me. They learned about the book from the net. I never heard of this group, but because because of, I said, I am a bad candidate for a radio interview because I have a hearing problem, and I have a breath problem. So I got another request from a group of students in Indonesia who had learned about the book through the internet. And, you know, so bit by bit, and moreover, the book has been translated into Arabic, Chinese, French, German, Russian, and Spanish. So so it can be read by college-educated people throughout the world. Maybe we should do Portuguese, but that was an expensive undertaking. So, so yes, people, you can get it, you will, it, we're just preparing e-editions of all those, of the book, in all those languages, and also of the study guide that goes with the book, which we have a few of them.
Yeah,
yeah,
they're here.
We have copies of the study guide here too. So yes,
I think that's what I wanted in the general context.
So that was the reason for the formation of the Workable World Trust, to disseminate the ideas in the book.
Thank you.
And it's happening, of course. Not at lightning speed, obviously, because you're a well-informed person and you haven't heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
But,
it's happening, I hear you.
And what hasn't been mentioned yet, I think, is very important. The book is published by the UN University Press. Mm-hmm. They don't just publish anything. Mm-hmm. This is just extremely on the mark as something that's very relevant for the people at the UN itself to take account of proposals being made about what you can do to make the UN more effective, workable world. One of the more important things, I think, is Joe's proposal about how to handle the assessment for how much each country should pay the UN. Right now, there's committees at the UN that work it up. Joe says, why don't we just make it a certain percentage of your gross national product, same percentage for every country?
If you said that every country, no matter how rich or poor, would pay 0.1% of its GNP or GNI to the UN system and to be allocated by another committee, then you'd have $75 billion as opposed to the total cost of all UN operations, of about $25 billion. So it'd be triple the revenue. And simplify the collection costs so that the smallest countries would pay about $20,000, because the United States can't. When we had Jesse Helms at the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he said, "Well, you know, we pay 20 at that time. It was 33%, I think." At that time, or whatever it was, I think it was 33% of the budget. We get one lousy vote. We're being, and Trump says the same thing. You know, we're being ripped off by the United Nations system. It's like one hamburger per American per year is what we're paying for the UN system. So at any rate, the United States couldn't use that dodge because they say you're paying the same percentage as an impoverished country like North Korea or the Democratic Republic of Congo or Haiti or Bolivia, some of the we're all paying 0.1%. You can find the money to pay 2% for your arms industry, but you can't pay 0.1%. In fact, our gross national product is about $43 trillion now, so 1% of that would be $43 billion, as opposed to what we are paying now for all parts of the UN system, the main budget and all the subsidiary funds like the World Population Fund and or the World Food Program. We pay about $8 now, so it would go up, but in an insignificant amount when you consider the total weight of the U.S. economy.
And it's so sensible and logical compared with what's going on now. Now the U.N. has this committee and how much does each country pay, and they have negotiations going on. What percentage should this country pay? What should this country pay? It's just a ridiculous system that presently exists mainly because strong countries like the United States insist on it. But, you know, it would be so simple to just have a straight percentage for each country, and that settles it, and we don't have to have all this diplomacy and seeing who can pressure who to take a smaller amount of assessment.
Yeah, I mentioned this proposal that Rand brought up about assessment at a meeting in which Catherine Bertini, most of you never heard of her, was present. She had been the treasurer of the World Food Program, which is the largest special fund in the UN at that time. I don't know if it still is. And she then became an auditor for the UN. And anyway, she knows the UN, but she says, that's brilliant. Why didn't anyone think of that before? And she, by the way, she's a Republican, too.
Oh.
So she's now at Syracuse University. But
other questions?
I don't think it's brilliant. I think it's utterly simple. But the fact is that people aren't thinking outside the box. And Debbie had a question.
Yes, so this is a wonderful way to deal with how the UN is financed. Do you recommend other books that talk about what the UN conceivably could do in the future?
Well, if you take the near-term book by Tom G. Weiss, or Weiss, he pronounces it Weiss, but he spells it
W-E-I-S-S.
It's called What's Wrong with the UN and How to Fix It. That's And then what's the one that, in terms of, reforms, there have been two UN civil servants, one who died recently, Sir Brian Urquhart of the UK, and Erskine Childers of the Republic of Ireland. They have written two books on UN reform under the auspices of the Dag Hammarskjöld Foundation and the Ford Foundation, one Swedish-based and one U.S.-based. They're very good, but I don't think they're on the market. I think it would be hard to get that today.
Yeah.
But Urquhart, U-R-Q-U-H-A-R-T, Brian, and Erskine Childers, Child Ers, they're good. And then there are reports of the... In 2005, there was a high-level panel on, help me out, Ron, on which was tasked with having UN reforms, promoting UN reforms. They put out about 150-page document with specific reforms, very few of which ever got to the floor of the General Assembly for debate. But more funds for peace building was one of the changes, and another that looked promising but didn't turn out as hoped was to reduce the size of the Human Rights Council. And and then Kofi Annan wrote his own report, which more or less was with a very few exceptions, a mirror of the former reporters. So this is a very big literature. If you have nothing better to do, you can spend all your time looking at it. But most of it just doesn't get seriously considered.
I think it's important to realize Jerry has been at this for 50 years. It's been his academic interest. He's coming at this from the point of view of what really needs to be done, without being motivated by what does my country gain from this, what does my country lose from this. So many of the people who are involved in the scholarship are coming at it from what's going to be good for my country, what's going to be good for some agency that I'm interested in. Joe is coming at this from a disinterested point of view, saying, here is the facts, here's what can be done, here's what should be done, and making these very specific proposals about how to do it. One of the main ones, of course, is right at the beginning to change the voting system. If you don't change the voting system in the General Assembly is virtually useless. What's the point of having 193 countries, each one casting one vote, regardless of its population or amount of carbon. The General Assembly is just kind of a laughing stock. Why bother even doing it? You can pass, the General Assembly can pass a resolution, oh, we ought to get rid of nuclear weapons. Well, but what does it mean when you've got a system of voting where each country, regardless of size or population, has one vote? I mean, think the one place where we saw that happening in the United States is under the Articles of Confederation, where each colony had one vote. And the result of that is we have a Senate where each state has two votes. That is the holdover from the Connecticut Compromise made in order to get the Constitution and get the small states to agree to it. Because Delaware said, you know, okay, we got to have our equal vote. We're a colony just like the other colonies, Rhode Island the same. So you had a compromise that ended up with a Senate where each country, where each state gets two votes regardless of its population.
And Utah and Wyoming love it.
Yeah, Wyoming likes that.
But you know, I'm glad we have it. Otherwise, we would have had Trump care.
Ron, how are we going to be able to get e-copies of this?
Well, they're for sale right
no,
here.
No, e-copies, so that we can share them around. He said, I think Joe said that pretty soon they're going to be on available electronically.
An electronic book.
It is available. If you Google the title, you can... It's sold by Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Help me out, Nancy.
Yeah, well, as far as the ebook in English, these little business cards have the book on the back and also the Brookings Institution Press website where you can order the book either print or online, e-version. And I think that the e-books through Amazon and such are only the French and the German and the Spanish are up there so far. So this Brookings address is going to be where you go for the English version. And there is a cost, I believe, $15 for the ebook.
I believe and it's published by the UN, he said. I thought Ron said
UN University Press went out of business 2 months after this book was published.
And that's Brookings.
No correlation.
So then Brookings is distributing it, is the distributor.
Yeah.
And that's one very unfortunate matter is that they, as Joe had indicated, they said we've never received such glowing recommendations from some such significant people on any book ever before. But, you know, UN funding was cut, and every year it basically stays the same, so UN programs have to keep getting cut, and that was cut 2 months later. So we've had to do sort of our own marketing to get the word out.
And that Brookings picked it up is pretty impressive.
Well, no, they are the North American agent for all UN university publications.
Isn't that a conservative outfit?
So it's
what, Brookings?
Yeah.
Oh, Joe or Ron?
Yeah.
No, Brookings Institute is a very prestigious organization that is bipartisan as you can be, doing the kind of work that they do.
Not like a conservative think tank.
Like
it's not like Heritage Foundation.
Yeah,
or something
Cato and all of those. But I thought they do have very conservative.
They do.
Too.
They're bipartisan. They do some conservative stuff and they do some liberal stuff.
After that, I do like that. Yeah, so you can get both.
It's stuff that they think is high quality.
Are there nations right now that support the UN a lot more than others?
The Nordic bloc are there, absolutely the number one. Switzerland's very, you know, a nation that's very influential in trying to promote UN reform, because nobody distrusts it, is Liechtenstein. It's got a population of about 25,000 or 30,000, but it has, I've met the ambassador from Liechtenstein on two or three occasions, and they take UN reform quite seriously. Mm. But Costa Rica's pretty good.
How about Germany?
Germany is pretty good, but Germany Germany's principal concern is to get on the Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's... there are two factions in Germany. One is that thinks that Germany should have its proper place in the world, you know, and another that realizes that Germany is just one state among many in a world system. Mm-hmm. So German opinion on the UN is quite divided.
Well, of course, you have France and then you have Great Britain.
Yes.
Okay. So, of course, Germany now is the most powerful nation in Europe.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So they want to be there. Yeah. So I find the United Nations very bureaucratic. And, of course, the United States is always, you know, what they want, they just press these little countries to get their way. Okay? And if they want to go to war, what do? They have all, we have all these countries, little Coalition. Countries like Vanuatu and little islands and nobody has ever heard of it. And they say, you see these countries, they... ridiculous, but... that's...
Coalition of the willing.
So, you know, I'm really taking that you've been fighting for this for 50 years, mm-hmm. so... And that you have written a book about it.
No. Oh, it's not. Joe wrote the book.
I came late in here.
Okay.
So, okay.
When I was saying I am doing these things, I had to explain I'm Joe.
Okay.
I'm Joe's voice. He's done that. I'm honored to work with Joe on all of this. Yeah. I mean, one unique thing is most people who are looking into the UN system or global governance system are in international relations. Mm-hmm. That's their academic field. Joe is was a professor at this university for decades in geography. And he's lived in many countries of the world. He's traveled to over 100 countries and lived in a number of them. And he has this very deep knowledge of geopolitics. So the way most international relations academics approach things is very different than his mindset. And this is why I admire Joe so much. A lot of academics are just in the ivory tower. Joe starts with the conclusion that we should save ourselves in this world. Okay, we start at that point, and then we work back to how do we do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so his academic, and this is, you know, in so many realms, Joe's a very strong peace and justice advocate, has been for decades in this community. And, you know, prior to the founding of the Minnesota Alliance of Peacemakers, as an mm-hmm. example. So his academics has always been for the purpose of actually making the world better. And so that's why I admire it, and that's why the ideas, as I say, it kind of starts with the conclusion, which is let's make it workable, maybe not utopia, but actually with all the reality of politics and human nature, how do we make something that can actually work? Decades of thought has culminated in this book. Go ahead.
I personally see the condition of the United Nations.
You might have to speak loud.
Okay.
I
can't project very. I'm not very well. But the thing is, I consider the condition of the United Nations a symptom of what's wrong with the United States, because they have been the dominant force
mm-hmm.
all along. To my knowledge, we basically helped create it.
Oh, yeah.
And we had the Nuremberg trials, we had all the things, declaring war as illegal and things like that. But then we got people like the Dulles brothers and all kinds of stuff, and the country has lost its... After with the New Deal and whatnot... We came to a situation where we realized that our country was very sick and that the symptom was the Great Depression. And so the thing is that I see the symptom of what's wrong with the United Nations is where the United States is today. Just like Trump, he's a symptom of what's wrong with our country. He is not the cause of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, for instance, we have to think about these different foundations. We have the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations. I've done some research on this.
Okay.
And the thing is that they're there for think tanks the Council on Foreign Relations, a lot of them. And so there, these. So the thing is, you got a bunch of heroes and heroines who are at the United Nations as NGOs, but they're being financed by the very same people who are responsible with what's wrong with our country right now. And so I think we need to look at that a little bit and kind of analyze it in that way.
Now, also shows exactly why Joe is coming from a different point of view than other people who are writing about the UN, because he's got the disinterested point of view.
Right.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people are worrying right now about getting corporate influence out of the UN. That's not so that we can get better at what we're doing. It's so we get, you know, water things that make some sense without corporations privatizing stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's not anything about, this is how to make it work.
How much does the book cost?
$30. It's normally 40 is 30 during the convention. We cannot take credit card.
If it matters to you, that's where you'd be happy to sign your book. That's an incentive.
So, yes. Joe, back to that assessed contribution, I wonder what your knowledge or sense is of currently the number of nations who are in fact over due time paying their assessment, and whether or not that they would, in your view, in your approach, they would be included only if they paid.
Right.
Whether but that winds up being a risk for them.
It would be one way to, not guarantee, but enhance the probability that nations would pay. Because if you,
right.
If you don't pay, you pay a price. And right now, if you don't pay...
So what?
So what? Yeah, right. So the there's a page in my book in which I have graduated circles for the sizes of in three different years of the actual amount paid and the arrearages at each period and by category of there are different accounts. I won't go into it now, but there's a lot of detail on how the money is spent and received or not received, as the case may be. So I can show you a copy of this chapter if you want.
Yeah. That's another point that I can make about the book. Just to get information about the UN, get this book. It's got oodles of information about what's been going on, what countries have been paying how much, and so on. So it's a very thorough history of what's been going on at the UN.
Let's see. Don't want to be talking right into your ears, Joe. Anyway, well, you know, I, I'm more involved in the aspects of the UN's activities that relate to, quote-unquote, making a better world, you know. Like, currently, pretty involved with the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Before, involved in activities that preceded that in the Millennium Development Goals. And I consider a lot of those efforts that come out of the UN as very significant and very important to make a better world. And I would like to see, I mean, I appreciate everything and concur with your remarkable effort and so on, not to minimize any of that. But is there a way that somehow one can connect? Because a lot of these things that we try to do, that UN tries to do to make a better world, and, you know, many wonderful things have been done, like dealing with SARS, for example. We wouldn't have had, or even Ebola thing, the kinds of support or the ones related to the end of HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and some of those things, and even some of the climate change issues. Now, a lot of those things, UN doesn't get much of a credit for. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for people to know all the good things that have happened and are happening because we have UN. And when we think of transforming the UN, somehow we need to include in it some of these positives as very significant. Like, in fact, even bring out some of the things like Millennium Goals didn't succeed as we wanted it, partly because a lot of the commitments supposedly given by the developed world, other than the Scandinavians and a little bit Germans, French, and the English, and Italy, other than those, most of the others didn't really come anywhere close to the commitment that was made. And so, therefore, some of these things did not work. And then, of course, there are always irregularities in the developing world. And so whatever was given to them was not properly, you know, utilized. Anyway, the point I want to make is that we have problems even in doing the good works because of our human nature and so on. And I think a book like this, which is working on transforming, would be great if it also incorporates how some of the good things that are going on can be done better. And by giving some examples, I mean that this is a...
I think that Joe does do that. I think in...
Well, no, I think
an important part of the book is how these very things that the UN are doing that are good can be more effectively done.
No, we need to go through by taking examples of things.
I think what we heard in the session just preceding this in room 130 about building a culture of peace, it's very important. And I would agree with you, Bard. I don't stress that as much as we should have. Partly, I wrote originally a book that would have been 600 pages in print, and they said, well, you've got to cut it down for economic reasons to 400 pages. That got short shrift. So some of this I would have gone into.
You have to write a book, Bharat.
Yeah.
It's a supplement, Joe.
Yeah, well, maybe there's a need for a follow-up.
But So I could only do so much.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
If people ask me, what do you think is the biggest accomplishment of the UN, I would make two. One was the passage of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. That would be one. And the other, objectively, arguably more important, is the complete elimination of smallpox. And the smallpox has killed far more people in the last century and a half than all wars put together.
Wow.
And but most of the Americans have never even met a person who's had smallpox.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going to a village in India. I happened to be, my area of expertise in academically is South Asia. And I went to a village once where I was doing some field work, and they asked me, are you here to give us the smallpox inoculations? I said, no, but why do you ask? He says, well, in the last month or so we lost 600 out of 1,800 people in our village from smallpox. One-third died. Most Americans never think of smallpox. They've never, as I said, met a person with smallpox. But in many parts of the world, the UN means something because it brings tangible benefits, and not equally, because obviously the wealthy countries of the world don't need these benefits. They need to pay for them. They do reap rewards which they're unaware of because a healthy population is a productive population. You can't do business with people who are starving to death, but if your people have a little discretionary income, they might buy your computer or your whatever it is you're trying to sell, automobiles, bicycles, to think that it's not a zero-sum game, it's a positive-sum game, and we have to realize that.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you. I'd like to say something about this lady who was concerned about the economic term and the occasion. I've probably given in my lifetime more than 500 talks on UN system or some aspect of my own research. The question I get more often than any other, because I speak to left of center audiences, is, well, you're rewarding people for their GNI, which, of course, contributions are based basically very highly correlated with gross national product or gross national income. You're rewarding them for having ripped us off and gotten rich at our expense. There's truth in that.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't deny it. On the other hand, you have to go from where you are to where you want to go. So you have to know where you are. And where you are is in a situation where countries are, as Ron has emphasized, out to maximize their own status and position in the world, and not to benefit humanity as a whole. So if you want to get them into the game, you can do that. But if you want the poor countries, or the countries who are relatively disempowered or less powerful, you have to give them hope. And the way to give them hope is that whenever you institute one of these changes, you say it will be reviewed at regular intervals, 10-year, but not less than every 10 years, so that you're not constantly fighting to change the system, so that there's hope for improvement of the system as it scores successes. And say, okay, and Nancy said you can increase the population term in that equation by making it 2p plus c plus m, or you can make it 3p, but you can't do it at once because you can't sell it. You have to sell an idea before you can implement an idea. And that's what a lot of people, good people, who are would-be reformers, don't realize.
Is there a way? I know we're over.
The back,
well, quarter to, yeah, 1 minute.
Oh, we do?
2 minutes.
Could I ask a question? Is there a way to make sure that this happens, the reforms, at every 10 years?
We can very well commit omnicide. That's a real problem. In fact, some people would say if you're taking odds in Las Vegas, it's the odds of omnicide are better than the odds of world government. Nothing is inevitable. The most powerful force is human will. And you have to generate that will, and that will works in exact opposition to the thing that keeps us, inertia. And inertia is the child of ignorance. And that's why we don't know how the world works. This lady was telling me in this session that Americans are, by and large, extremely ignorant about how the world works. You're right.
Yeah.
We have to correct that. And if we don't, it will be at our own peril. Now, there are people like Al Gore who says, well, this is an inconvenient truth that we have to recognize. There are other people, Margaret Mead, who says that never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world. In fact, I don't have the exact quote. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Victor Hugo said, there's nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come. There are all these hopeful signs. The Roman philosopher Seneca said that it is not because it is difficult that we are afraid. It is because we are afraid that it is difficult.
Yeah.
So those are quotations from the book, by the way. We can do it, but we have to make up our mind that survival is more important than getting rich.
So we better end the session officially, Feel free to ask questions.
I have a closing remark. If you're really interested in this topic and have friends and associates who are here that you'd like to have them the opportunity, this will be presented tomorrow.
Saturday at the same time.
Saturday at the same time.
Yeah.
In the
same room.
We'll still
be here. Go ahead and ask your question. I just want to make sure everyone feels comfortable to leave as you need to. Just your break in between sessions.
Yeah, I admire your very positive manner. This is great because I am not sometimes.
Nice to be hopeful?
Yeah, absolutely. Because sometimes you see that you're really gay, ready.
Yeah. And he's hard.
Yeah. Thank you. Nice meeting both of you.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
What I wanted to say is, the reason, what happened in 1969, I was a chief petty officer on a nuclear submarine with nuclear missiles. And we were going to battle stations during every week, and I had 6 children at home, and if we got the word, we had agreed that we were going to push a button and probably destroy an entire country, and we had 42 other countries that we could take on. And so so the thing is, I got out. I just quit. 12 and a half years in, I quit my career. And I went on what I call a quest for human unity. And I think that that is really what is should be at the core of what the United Nations is. And like, for instance, the communist system does not work because the party's over the people. So you got the contradiction between the people and the party. And then we know that the two-party system doesn't work because we see it right now. We've seen it with the Great Depression and whatnot. And we got the multi-party system is falling apart in Europe, and for the same reasons. And so the point is that I don't speak with the words of academia. I speak from the words of what I see, have seen in the world, and I've read about. I've read a lot of academia and whatnot. But the only thing is, I'm saying that what we will have human unity when the power of love overcomes the love of power. And that's basically it, and there's only one way we're going to get there. I've decided that. I declare it right now, and I to everybody that I see, is we have to have full-on democracy. In other words, our founding fathers did not. They thought we'd get mobocracy because people were ignorant. I mean, the slaves, they kept them from getting an education. So you would have perhaps had, but that's what happened with the French Revolution. But the thing is that the democracy of the French Revolution was liberté, égalité, and fraternity.
Yeah.
And so the way we would say that is freedom, equality, and friendship. And the equality part is what we're missing, because we're not willing to maintain our status. We're not willing to say that what we should do is have everybody has an equal education. Everybody has equal access to true information, true history, not victor's history. We also have to have equality. I mean, we have to have an equal vote, equal voice, an equal vote. And but the only thing is, the only way we're going to get there is people are going to have to give up their status that they get through being an intellectual, to being a Wall Street money lender, which, you know, people who talk about this, when you talk like this is socialism and communism, no, it goes back. I mean, if you're a Christian, for instance, Jesus throwing the money lenders out of the temple. That's what we need to do right now, is we need to, instead of Obama's solution in this great recession that we had, should have done what they did with Bill Black with the savings and loan. They should have all been they should have been charged criminally and judged as criminals. And we need to go back to the United Nations. We have started. We have come up with the rule that going to war is a crime against humanity. And that is what we need to do. This is coming from the mouth of somebody who studied this out in the Shark Tank. In other words, I've gone through all the alphabet soup of the left, and I've been the Christian fundamentalism and all of this. And this is my conclusion, is that we have to have full democracy, because it's not an ism. It's not a formula. In other words, it's just a neutral process where every time you take a vote, it all comes out in the wash, and we move forward. That is my opinion after 32 years. Maybe other people here spent more years than that. But I devoted almost... I work two days every day. I sleep 4.5 hours, and I work 1 hour, and then I take a nap in the afternoon. And I've worked on this for 32 years.
What's the name of your book? you have one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keep Your Eye on the Prize of Human Unity. Stop All the Contradictions.
Okay.
And so we're all equal, and we can all get along then, because we all treat each other as human beings. That's my conclusion.
All right. Thank you.